WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are completely calm, totally local, and keeping it Baltimore Positive. Don Moeller joining us here, my Baltimore Positive cohort in all things COVID and all things pandemic and crisis in Catonsville. And hey, you know, we still have curbside for a couple of our places, right, Don? I know you said that the crab cakes down at Fadley's. We're still doing things over at State Fair, and I know your boy Jeff Moeller's closing deals over there in Catonsville, and Moeller and Gary, right?
Moeller and Gary Realtors still selling real estate, listing real estate, selling real estate. Amazing that they're able to do that through the pandemic, through the joys of technology. And we mentioned that Fadley's has curbside delivery, and Nestor, the latest development with State Fair is that they're recognizing this whole food insecurity and supply chain issue, and they now are boxing up produce and protein, complete boxes of food. So rather than folks run to the grocery store, you can just call State Fair. They'll bring that whole box of food right to your car curbside. It's one-stop shopping, so it's a great service. And again, I think we're proud. We're talking about healthcare week, really social safety net week, and you're ready to invite a really important guest in that whole battle right now in the state of Maryland.
Well, I mean, if you've heard of Care First and Blue Cross and Blue Shield, this is the guy that sits at the top of that and all of COVID and all the regular, normal medical things that are going on. I have a card in my own pocket. Brian Pennock is the president and CEO of Care First, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. Here, he will come in with some sort of a Philadelphia accent, and I've already given him a hard time in the green room about Southern New Hampshire University, but we call this Baltimore Positive, Brian, and I can't imagine how many people in Baltimore have a little card in their wallet or wherever they keep their card that has your company's name on it. And I would think the first thing that happens, if God forbid you get a fever, you have any of these symptoms, the first thing you think is, who's my insurer? Where are we going? And I think this is overtime for everyone in your industry. I really appreciate you taking a little time out here 5-6 weeks into this pandemic to try to communicate with us and our audience and educate people out there, because I think a lot of folks are looking for real news and real information right now, and I appreciate you taking a little time. Thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, and I appreciate, given how broad your followership is and the energy that you guys bring to conversations relevant to our community, I just couldn't be more pleased to have a chance to highlight some of the work that we're doing, and I think the incredible things that we're seeing in the community as a whole. So happy to be here.
Well, Don will tell you that I'm the village idiot, and the reason we put this thing together a year and a half ago was for me to learn, you know? And I don't know where I learned, but my wife was diagnosed with leukemia 6 years ago last month. She's had 2 bone marrow transplants at Hopkins. She's Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you know, carrying the card and a couple $1 million of insurance. I mean, it certainly would have wiped us out, you know, through all of this stuff. So, I mean, my familiarity is that when anything went wrong, we had to call in, right, and find out, well, is this covered or is that covered? But along those lines, for the vulnerable people out there, for how many people you were anticipating 6-8 weeks ago that would be coming into hospitals, getting care, getting tests, all of these things that are going on, the testing part of this has really moved to the forefront for those of us who at least feel safe for the time being to say, how do we get our society back on track and get back to work? And I think part of that is going to be just safety for people and feeling like they can go back out and interact again after all of us want to give a hug to somebody right now, right?
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think it's you know, if you want to pick up on the positive perspective here, it's that the impacts that I think the public and the private work that's being done are really making a difference, and so we're fortunate to be in a position where we've got really, really strong leadership coming out of state, really strong leadership coming out of our local government, and we've got a private sector that was out in front of this and has been for several months. I think the danger is apathy, right? We don't want to pull back at this point from taking the steps that we've taken to ensure that not just the health issues that we're dealing with, but really the capacity challenges that creates are exacerbated. And so I think the balance that we're looking to strike is how do we stay positive, but also stay mindful that the things we're being asked to do as households and as businesses are having an impact, and we really need to continue to do them.
Talk a little bit about, Brian, that touches on so many things. Talk about this pandemic from a healthcare perspective. In other words, it began, you know, it became clear, you know, whether it's a month ago, 2 months ago, we'll let others sort out.
when people knew what the actual scope would be. But when your team at Care First began to recognize, all right, guys, we're in uncharted water, talk about how Care First got ready for this pandemic and what you all had to do.
Yeah, and plenty will be arbitrated in retrospect, but at this point, I think for most of us, specifically in the healthcare communities, our efforts have spanned the past several months. And so this continued to be uncharted territory. But for us, as a not-for-profit, mission-driven health services company and the region's largest insurer, we entered with a clear sense of prioritization. And this theme of prioritization, I think, is going to be critical, not just to getting us through the initial health crisis, but also the economic crisis that's traveling in its wake. So when the situation began to escalate in the United States, we formed a task force like many others. And in our case, the task force reports directly to me and to our executive leadership team. And then from there, it's really having a clear sense of where your priorities need to be to organize effectively. And so we prioritized around the health and safety of our workforce. We wanted to get people out of offices, get them working remote safely, ensure that they had what they needed. We needed to maintain business continuity and uninterrupted service to our customers. This is critically important. We sit at the nexus of healthcare issues, but also economic issues. People need to see that we've got strength and stability that can be maintained, even in the midst of some challenging circumstances. And then from there, it's really about removing barriers. We removed barriers to care for our members. We ensured that the economics in individual households and for individual people wouldn't be a reason that they didn't go in to get testing where it's available, to have treatment when it's needed and required, and to ensure that there was a strong relationship between the patients and the providers in the community that wasn't inhibited by any financial concerns. And then we've started to help address immediate financial pressures for businesses and members. Financial strain has been, unfortunately, a great consequence of what we're seeing here with COVID-19. For our households and for our businesses, you know, this pullback, this very necessary stay-at-home order and the social distancing that's really traveled in its wake, it's been a big part of our success, but it's also been a big driver of the economic concerns. And so what we've tried to do is really alleviate some of the near-term pressures that households and businesses are feeling with the cost of premium, so the dollars that they pay to us to ensure coverage, and implementing practices like interest-free advances on premium, deferrals on premium, that allow for them to maintain coverage without experiencing significant financial strain. And then supporting frontline providers and clinical resources. So they're obviously out there on the front lines. They have family and friends that they're looking to care for, but they're also needed in clinical setting to ensure that the people that have to get care can receive it in a timely and appropriate way. And so we recognize that they're seeing the health experience, but they're also seeing the financial strain of COVID-19 readiness and response, and for many, a pullback of their patient base. And so Care First has taken steps to try to put more money into circulation for doctors and hospitals so that they can cover those expenses and continue to provide that care. And then I think the last piece has really been the partnership with our communities on readiness, response, and relief efforts. You know, if this is a nine-inning game, you know, I think most of us believe that we're probably somewhere in the second or third inning. I think we're doing pretty well, frankly, in this region with how the public and private sector have stepped up to address the immediate health issues. A lot of work still needs to be done to ensure we can wrap our arms around this with a greater degree of confidence. But coming out of this, we're going to need to give people a helping hand to lift them out of economic strain. And we've really been working hard to try to provide that support across a myriad of ways in our communities.
Brian Pennick is our guest. He is the president and CEO of Care First, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. You know, I want to go back to the beginning of this because there have been a couple times throughout this that you've said, we want you to stay home. We need you to stay home. It's important you stay home. When's the first time this came to your desk? Let's say back in January, February. You know, I spent time in Asia in December. So, you know, I was a little bit more familiar with it maybe than it hit the front page of the paper, hit the evening news maybe when we got into February after Wuhan. But I would think for someone in your industry to say, if this thing comes here and we have hundreds of thousands of people hospitalized in our state, let's say what has happened in New York or what's happened in the northern portion of Italy, to say what it would do to your system and then to see see that, like, Georgia and Florida are just letting people loose. And I'm thinking, hey, if you were the guy in Georgia right now, you'd be saying, whoa, 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 you're going to flood my hospitals. You're going to flood my system. This isn't safe. And I would think on your side, even though I'm sure you have a legal department and all sorts of strains and constraints and thoughts and people on both sides of the aisle, you're a medical organization. You are on the science side of this is a pandemic. This isn't the flu. And trying to educate people, even in Georgia, as we speak, talking about opening up for all sorts of things that aren't 6 feet away, I'm concerned for the Brian Penick of the Blue Cross in Georgia right now as much as I am for the citizens, right?
Yeah, I think it's the honest answer is that this moved faster and more comprehensively than just about anybody predicted. And I completely agree with the notion that it really started to garner significant attention from inside the healthcare community, probably starting in the month of January. But it really wasn't until February that I think the pace and the magnitude started to take some shape. And in the late February, early March timeframe, I think many of us inside the healthcare community really started to look at this and say, we've got to start preparing in earnest and preparing in a way that, frankly, we haven't been asked to prepare for in the past. And I think it's always challenging. Anytime people are experiencing a different level of effect, right? How does this impact me personally? What do I see from a day-to-day perspective? You're always going to get divergent viewpoints. But I don't think you have to look far. You can look across the world, you know, where this has been felt in just about every country. You can look across the country state by state in the United States, and we can see that there is a corollary between the social practices that have been implemented by government and the management of the overall effect on local communities. And so you're certainly going to hear me continue to advocate for this idea that we've got to be incredibly restrained, incredibly thoughtful about how we approach this, and in our desire, in our urgency to try to get the economy restarted, that we not inadvertently create a second, more significant challenge on the healthcare side that'll ultimately impact the economy, I think, much further into the future. And so that's the balance that I think we're trying to affect. For our part, I met with my team last Friday. We had more than 4,000 people that were dialed into a call with myself and a couple of our leaders. And I said to them, look, you're going to hear a lot of messaging from the federal government. You're going to even hear some messaging at the state and local levels. But for Care First part, you know, we're going to keep people home well into the immediate future to ensure that whatever the circumstances are, that if we bring you back, when we bring you back, we do so safely and responsibly, not just for the health of our associates, but also for the health of our communities.
Well, Brian, in addition to all of your employees that you have to worry about, you're on the front lines of what I refer to, and I wouldn't expect you to defend the entire healthcare system in the United States of America, but recently I've seen reports that the number may be as high as 25 or 30 million Americans who will lose their employee health care during this crisis because they get laid off. What do we have in place as a safety net for those folks who are losing their health care, many of whom I imagine have Care First, and all of a sudden it's gone? What's out there for those folks to provide a social safety net during this unprecedented time?
Yeah, I think like many other things, it's a multi-layered approach. I think first and foremost, companies like Care First are offering employers the opportunity to defer premium payments. And so, you know, we've allowed those companies that are experiencing significant downward pressure financially and to try to keep people employed and by default keep them insured, an opportunity to defer a portion of their payments to us, and then to pay it back over an extended period of time without any interest or penalties. And so I think that's a first line of defense for those that are seeing some immediate cash flow challenge and downward pressure to their businesses. But to your point that we are seeing, and I think we're going to continue to see, some unprecedentedly high unemployment numbers and people affected by other measures like furloughs. And really, the safety net for that is a fewfold. I think, one, we're fortunate to be in a region where Medicaid expansion has been a reality. Not every part of the country has seen that coming out of the ACA era, but we've seen that, and we've seen it comprehensively in places like Maryland and the District of Columbia. And so Medicaid exists as a safety net in local communities for people that are experiencing financial stress and strain. And we believe that Medicaid will likely in the near term expand in terms of the number of people that are taking advantage of that program and being supported by that program. I also think that there's been some pretty comprehensive conversations with the federal government that additional aid, as we think about another package of stimulus, is going to be required to try to help support people through those transition times and to ensure that there is additional funding made available for coverage like COBRA, right? When you terminate your coverage, you have access to COBRA coverage, but that COBRA coverage is paid out of pockets by individuals. Well, by default, if you're losing your job, your financial situation is not in good standing, and to protect those limited resources that households have, we really think there's an opportunity for government to step in and help support the coverage costs associated with COBRA. The other steps that we're taking is that we, in partnership with the state of Maryland and with the District of Columbia, have actually expanded the special enrollment periods for individuals to get coverage on their own. We've done that not just in our partnership with each of the exchanges in D.C. and Maryland. We've also done that in our direct business. So people don't necessarily have to rely solely on accessing healthcare through an employer to get access to a company like CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield. And when they get access, we can then provide them with additional assistance through things like deferred premium payments. So it's going to be a multifaceted approach. I think we in the private sector and government at the state and federal level are going to need to think creatively and beyond the bounds of what we've considered in the past to ensure that what we do is enough. And then I think the obligation we have is as quickly as we can, as safely as we can, as responsibly as we can, help businesses to recover from this in the right time and with the right kind of support.
One of the challenges...
Go ahead, Don.
Now,
I was just going to say, Brian, when as you talk, I'm thinking you use that term multifaceted a number of times. And I'm thinking, boy, this... Of all the issues that Nestor and I are taking a look at and a deep dive into, this issue of healthcare during this is really complicated because it seems to me, Brian, that in addition to the responsibility that you feel, and obviously you take seriously when you talk about making sure that your folks can have the healthcare that they've had and that they can remain covered, at the same time, you've got a bottom line that you have to address. Talk to us a little bit about the impact and how you're managing your own financial crisis at CareFirst during what has to be an incredible challenge.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I would say a few things. The first is beware false precision. You're going to see a lot of people trying to fill the void these days with models and projections and analysis, and the reality is, the data is still maturing. You know, we're all collecting information, and as much as people want to relate this to other things that they've experienced in business or in their personal lives, I think the most honest answer is this is unprecedented for us. None of us have been through something like this, not at this scale, not in this way. And so I think we've got to be careful, and we've really got to be thoughtful about, as we draw information in, not to over or underreact, but to assess where our contributions and our help can be best deployed and when it should be deployed. And so, you know, we're a company who needs to inspire its customer base with a sense of, we're going to be here for you. We're going to be here for you through the good times. We're going to be here for you through the bad times. And you don't have to worry that when you walk into that doctor's office with that CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield card, whether or not your coverage is going to be able to be maintained because of the financial health and security of the company. At this point, the company is sober about the challenges that we're all dealing with. We frankly sit at the nexus of employer challenges, of household challenges, and the needs that they have of us. And some gaps potentially in the payments that they can make to us or people that can be insured. And then we sit on the other side trying to support healthcare practitioners who need to be available and financially stable enough to provide care, and not just care today, but to make it through this health crisis so they can be there for local communities as we emerge out of this. In our models, and we're tracking a number of different scenarios, we're projecting, you know, anything as high as more than $500 million of total economic impact for 2020. Now, the good news is that as a company, we've managed effectively historically, and we continue to manage responsibly in the here and now. And we believe that the measured steps that we're taking to support businesses but also providers are the right steps to take, and we're going to continue to do that. Watching that closely is going to be incredibly important, but so far we feel good about our ability to really continue to stay in this fight shoulder to shoulder with both the public sector as well as other organizations in the private sector who are doing the same.
Brian Pennock is our guest. He is the president and CEO of Care First. Blue Cross Blue Shield is probably in your pocket. If it's not, it's probably in your neighbor's pocket. The COVID situation, it comes as over the last 8 weeks when people were already having cancer and people were already having surgeries and people were already having appointments. And telemedicine has become something, that it becomes the way my wife stays in touch with her endocrinologist through this or her cancer doctors through all of this. I think for a lot of people, and to say, at what point do I get a doctor's visit? At what point do I go back to, I'm covered, I'm insured, and I got a cough, and I don't think it's COVID, and, I don't want to leave the house, and I'm taking Sudafed or whatever I have, or, whatever those things are to avoid a doctor, avoid a health care cost, and more than that, to try to stay out of the way for the doctors and the nurses on the front lines of COVID. I think that this is so complicated in that way. And then if I think I have COVID, what happens insurance wise for me and an otherwise healthy person to say, what hospital do I go to? And I know a lot of these hospitals thought of themselves as rivals through the course of time, but I think much like the National Football League, they're all in business together. And MedStar, LifeBridge, Mercy, St. Agnes, GBC, BMC, we've talked to all these people and the Maryland Hospital Association. I think this thing has brought together medicine and brought together insurance and brought together some sort of a think tank in a way that maybe nothing else could have to bring a city like New York together and governors and red and blue and Democrat and Republican to say, we have a national crisis here. We have to work through this together. And I think bringing hospitals together, that's how we save lives, is when you put good people together, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And you touched on a couple of important points. I think anytime you see crisis, anytime you see challenge, it's really a test of what each of us is made of. And I think each of us being organizations, each of us being people, I think for the most part, the community should feel proud of the institutions and the organizations that have responded to this and the way that they're responding to it. And I also think that you see beyond collaboration, you see innovation. The adage that necessity is the mother of all invention, I think, is never more true when we're dealing with grand necessity. And this is a situation of grand necessity. And so I think notions around what healthcare settings look like and how virtual health will begin to take hold is already taking hold in ways that had been discussed but never fully realized. We're not going to likely return back to the exact same orientation to business environments and the exact same orientation to healthcare access as we left. And I think similarly, I'd like to believe that we're not going to return back to traditional separations and fragmentation in the healthcare community. This has been an incredibly binding force for us. We're seeing partnership, obviously, locally in the greater Baltimore region with the city of Baltimore, with the counties surrounding the city, with the state. But we're also seeing organizations like UMS and Hopkins and MedStar and LifeBridge and St. Agnes and GBMC and Mercy and others coming together to say, listen, we've got a common enemy here and we've got a common problem here. And it's going to take the combined and coordinated assets and resources of all of us to manage this most effectively. And I think, in addition to the social practices that the governor had implemented early on, it's really been that close coordination and that close collaboration between our organization and others that's kept this in a manageable state for as long as it's been. So I'm optimistic that many relationships that have been forged, through these difficult times will persist beyond this, and that will come out of it will be a better healthcare reality for people in the community.
Well, Brian, you talked about it, and you have a company to run, so we appreciate you taking time to chat with us. We'll let you go here shortly. But you talked about collaboration, and I'm curious. I think our listeners would like to know. You recently have announced a partnership with Baltimore City, I think Hopkins, University of Maryland Medical. Talk a little bit about that partnership as it fits into your collaboration theme, how it came about, and what it's accomplishing.
Yeah, so this is really was born out of a lot of good work that was being done at Johns Hopkins Medicine, University of Maryland Medical System, and CareFirst, coming together and really beginning to discuss with one another the challenges that we were seeing and experiencing, as well as the concern that we had for our local communities. And I think as we prioritize, and back to this notion of deciding where your resources can be best deployed, one of the things that we shared as a common belief was this idea that metropolitan areas were going to experience this in a much more significant way. And that's due to dense population, poverty, high prevalence of chronic medical conditions. And so it led the three organizations to really get into contact with and to start a discussion with the city of Baltimore as well as the state to say, what would a public-private partnership in the midst of these circumstances look like? How can we pull the best of what each of us offers from an organizational perspective? And who else in the healthcare community can we potentially invite into this type of collaboration? And so the work that's being done and what's been stood up over the past several weeks has been more substantial than anything I've seen across this type of relationship. So we've got call centers and that are staffed by our call teams, but also clinicians from across the healthcare systems. There's a 24/7 access. Anyone in the community can call. So if you need help, if you need a resource, you dial 211 in the greater Baltimore metropolitan area. You get access to resources that can give you advice on where to go and what to do if you or a loved one feel ill. We're holding regular briefings to provide the most up-to-date information about COVID-19 and the city's collective response, really, so what we're doing, how we're doing it, to better understand, but also, I think, to fill some of that information void that exists out there. We're increasing the availability of testing and testing sites, which is going to be critical not just to manage the virus in the near term, but also economic restart in the long term. Our hospital partners are collecting and sharing citywide data about the availability of resources like medical supplies and ventilators. I don't have to tell you or your audience that this has been widely covered. The challenges associated with availability of resources and coordination of resources has been significant. We're fortunate to have health systems working together to manage that here locally. And then we're constantly collecting data to identify hotspots that may develop in neighborhoods. So we've got data. There's other public resources and private resources that have data. For the first time, I think we're coming together to bring that full view to ensure that we can see where the need is most dramatic and how to manage that need. And then we're working to increase the capacity for social distancing and quarantining for individuals experiencing homelessness or incarceration. So we've had underserved populations going into this health crisis. We've got underserved populations today. And so the collaboration is really focused on how do we make sure that those that have not historically seen the highest levels of service are supported most effectively through this and receive the kind of care that everyone is receiving and that we can manage some of the unique circumstances. And then we're coordinating care in transportation at all levels of severity to ensure that patients can be transitioned from one facility to another or treated at home. And so you get a sense. This is a massive infrastructure undertaking, and it's all been conceived and stood up substantively over the course of the past several weeks, and it's out there right now helping the community manage through the crisis.
Brian, last thing for you. My wife and I think we had the virus. My wife spent a month in bed in January, two times, checked for flu, tested negative, didn't make it to the Super Bowl, didn't even make it to the Lamar Jackson game. And we would love to get a test at some point and make this happen, and I know, thankfully, our governor's wife is South Korean, which is where we were in December, and we came back from Asia. We had a great time, great barbecue over there as well. But they sent us 500,000 tests, and Governor Hogan came out earlier in the week, and obviously the president has his point of view on this. The thoughts about getting tested and the next thing that happens. This is the next thing, right? And you just touched the point about that a minute ago. What do you know, at least in the early stages, of what that's going to look like for Blue Cross Blue Shield?
Yes, so I cannot overstate the importance of testing capacity. It's critically important to managing in the here and now, and it's absolutely essential to ensuring that there is a thoughtful reopening.
That is the science of it, right? Literally.
That's the science for sure. And believe the science. It's absolutely where we need to stay grounded. I would say a couple of things. I think the governor's been strong in his leadership. He was out early and I think confidently in providing a very sober perspective to the people of the state and providing guidance on what we should and shouldn't be doing. How should we be thinking about this as households and as businesses? I applaud him for his efforts and the efforts of his wife and the administration and really going after this directly and ensuring that at least Maryland has access to far greater testing capacity than it did just a week ago. But this is still early, and I think even the governor has said, you know, this is a first step, this is an important step, it's a significant step, but additional supplies will be needed, additional coordination will be needed. So I think to some degree we're ahead of the game by having another 500,000 diagnostic test kits, and that's really determining whether or not you are actively infected. But the science and the availability around antibody testing is going to have to continue to improve as well to identify people that have either had this or have built some degree of immunity and potentially are comparatively fit to return to a physical workspace.
Well, I might be an antibody guy, right? Like if I had it, right? So that's one of the reasons I want to figure this thing out, because I might be able to save some people, you know?
Yeah. And there's a lot of research, you know, to your point, you know, experimental treatment in terms of blood plasma therapy and identifying people that can donate for that as well. But I want to just make sure that we come back to this. This is all progress, and I think positive is definitely where we want to be. We want to be positively supportive of the progress that's being made, but it is still early. So I think it's good that we're increasing testing capacity on the diagnostic side. We need to increase testing capacity on the antibody side. We need to then determine how best to distribute availability of both types of tests back into the community to support staged reopening. I believe that's where the state government's head is at. I believe that's where the local government head is at, and I believe that's where the majority of the private sector is at right now. If we do that and we do it thoughtfully, I think we take our best shot at this, and I think we get it more right than not.
Well, I love your second inning thing. That's right up Mohler's alley. We'll get your Phillies back on the field, Mohler's Orioles back on the field here at some point, right? Brian, really appreciate you coming on. Don, you done with Brian? We're going to let him go back and do all the things he does, run a Care First, Blue Cross, Blue Shield.
I'm going to say this is like, can you name that tune in 30 seconds? Brian, what have you learned about yourself through this?
I would say what I've learned about myself is that even in the most significant challenges that you can imagine personally and professionally, there's always a silver lining. And I shared this with my team a couple of weeks back. You know, we've felt the effects of this in ways both indirectly and directly. But on the upside, this is the first time in a very long time that I've been able to sit down and have dinner with my kids and with my wife every night for over a month now. And you've really got to take advantage of those moments and that perspective to stay grounded and to continue to do your best work and to do it compassionately and empathetically. So even in the midst of challenge, there comes great opportunity and I think some silver linings for all of us. Let's make sure we don't lose sight of that.
Nestor, drop the mic.
There we go. Brian, I appreciate you taking some time and appreciate all the Blue Cross Blue Shield and Care First have done for our family as well. And obviously, I shared our story here. My wife was real, real familiar with all the billing by the time it all came together. And we're still put together here, and we'll get through this crisis together as well. Appreciate your time. Hope we can all get together and elbow bump sometime soon, pal.
Appreciate it, guys. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Brian Pennick joining us here, President and CEO of Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield. We are WNST.net. We're keeping calm. We're staying local. We're always Baltimore positive. Big shout out to all of our sponsors supporting us here. Many of them open right now, whether it's Royal Farms and Pizza John's and our dear friends at State Fair. Stop by there, get some chicken and waffles, of course, downtown at Fadley's, where they're doing crab cakes curbside, as well as our friends at Mohler and Gary Realty, where they're still closing deals. And I've just been inspired by how the real estate communities come together to say, we can do this virtually. The automotive industry, we can do this virtually. Dennis Colatsos will be here with draft coverage this week as well. Big thanks to Don Mohler, our whole team, and the crew with Damian O'Doherty and KO and Steve and all the crew for putting an incredible healthcare week together here as we start to talk about your health, my health, our health, and staying healthy during this COVID crisis. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. We're keeping calm. We're staying local. I'm shaving and dressing up with my freedom patch and staying Baltimore positive.